First of all, thank you all for joining us early in the morning, certainly early for me. The Toronto Comic Arts Festival would like to acknowledge that the land in which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, and the Indigenous peoples who lived on and cared for this land for more than 15,000 years. This territory is covered by the Dish With One Spoon Wampum Belt Treaty, and today, Toronto is still the home to many Indigenous people from across the Turtle Island. We acknowledge the settlers on the land directly benefit from the process of colonization. In recognition of our gathering on these lands for TCAP 2018, the festival has made a donation to the Native Child and Family Services of Toronto. We look forward to increasing our support and programs for Indigenous creators in the years to come. I'd also like to thank our sponsors. Programming at TCAF is sponsored by Seneca College's Faculty of Communication, Art, and Design. TCAF would also like to thank our presenting sponsors, the Beguiling, Little Island Comics, and the Toronto Public Library. I'd also like to thank our media sponsor, Now Magazine, and we recognize the support of the Canada Council for the Arts, the Ontario Arts Council, the Toronto Arts Council, and of course, the Beguiling, Peter, and Chris Butcher, who make this train run. I'd like to introduce our guests. We're here for a panel on bizarre romance, and we have Audrey Niffenegger and Eddie Campbell here. So I want to begin with the first story in
well,
here.
The video lunch first.
We could do the video lunch.
Let's start with that.
Let's start with that.
Get the noise out of the way because it's a library up in town. And I think it's a great idea to have a comics festival in a library. Who would have thought? Who would have thought that?
This is a pretty interesting library.
Yeah.
We can see that it is magnificent.
Right, hold on a minute. This is a little video that we've got on our websites. It was made by Audrey's assistant, Ken Gerlieve. And essentially, it's a bunch of characters that Audrey had already done for something else. And we just put in most of the characters from the book, from Bizarre Romance. And we had the tune that was perfect for a Skeleton Jangle by the New Orleans Dixieland Jazz Band. And for some reason, they were giving us trouble about using that. So we got some guys to record a new version of the song's not out of copyright, but we were getting some flack about using the recording, which is a 1917 recording.
It wasn't really flack. They wanted to put ads on it. And we said, we will not let your ridiculous capitalism infect our nice art, so we re-recorded it.
So we hired musicians, and they did a lovely job of this. Here, you'll see my ridiculously cluttered desktop showing here from time to time, but just ignore that.
Recently,
when was it? I can't remember. But they said, What do we want? What is it?
Let's see, what do we want? Evidence-based science. When do we want it? After peer review.
Well, let's start at the beginning, because the first time that I realized that you guys were collaborating was on in The Guardian. And actually, because Toronto is a great city, you can actually get physical copies of The Guardian.
Yeah.
So I went and got it, and was really struck by it. But how did the collaboration come about?
That summer, the British Library was having an enormous exhibit that was curated by Paul Gravett. And to celebrate, they asked Paul to invite some people to do some comics for the Guardian's magazine. And it was the premise was novelists do comics, which sounds a bit obscene. But Paul invited us because we sort of came ready-made as a team. And previously, when Eddie and I first got together, I said, oh, we could collaborate. And he said, oh, no, darling. I was like, all right. So, but when Paul said, oh, yeah, you guys could collaborate, he's like, okay. So obviously, Paul has more pull in this relationship than I do. But yeah, so, and it worked out. And we really had a good time doing it. By the time we were trying to do that collaboration, we were... we'd met in London and we were back in our respective corners of the globe. So Eddie was in Brisbane and I was in Chicago. And if you took a globe and you put your fingers on those two cities, they would be about as far apart as cities can be. So we did everything by email and telephone.
It's unusual to me because you're both writers, you're both artists. So how did you figure out the division of labor on that story?
That particular story was a complicated one. I was talking about this yesterday. These two science characters that Audrey had created, I didn't have anybody in mind. I didn't have any actors in my repertory company that would fit those two. So I said, you're going to have to draw these two nutcases. And just draw them in as many different positions as you can think of. And email them over and I'll work them into the picture somehow. I'll even thicken up the lines if they don't match what's already in the pictures or whatever. So that's the only story where Audrey drew some of the characters in. In fact, she drew the male lead and I drew the female lead. And it's the one story in the book that is a romance. It begins with them giving her the... I thought I had it, but I don't.
It's the very first one.
It must be. Ow, I can't find that.
I want to know what Thursdays means, but anyway, there you go.
I can tell you.
I know, I've read the book.
The premise of the story is that this mysterious character that she's married, he has to have Thursdays free between 6 and 8, and she doesn't know what he's going to get. She doesn't know what he's getting up to on those nights. It's a mystery. So, a mystery romance. Audrey didn't want to call this book Bizarre Romance. She was against that. She said, hold it up there. She said, if we call this Bizarre Romance, we'll end up with a pink cover and hearts and flowers.
Now, there is a heart there between the two of you guys.
Oh, yeah.
So
there are flowers, too. Little tiny flowers. Yeah, once we had that title, I was like, okay, let's just roll with it. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Eddie doesn't understand the danger if you're a female author and they get you into the chick lit section, you will never get out. I mean, you could go in there with, you know, weaponry and they would not let you out of chick lit, so you have to be careful about letting anybody say the word romance in proximity to your work.
Oh, no. I have thought of that. The one thing that really struck me about the book, it's 13 stories, and they're all... different. I mean, both in terms of the way that you've written them, but also in terms of the art style. And I walked away from it feeling that it was connected by theme. So it kind of felt like we're old people. It felt like an album. It felt like 13 songs, which is what you used to get on album.
This is what, have you heard us talk about this before? This is what,
yeah,
this is what we've been saying.
He's got it.
Because
got
no, it. I say this to Audrey, it's like an album. You know, they used to have 13 songs. I don't know why.
And the seventh one was always the best song.
Yeah. They used to be 12, and they thought, we'll give them one more than Vic. You know, Decca would think, we'll give them one more than Vic, the Columbia's given them, or whatever. And so they had 13 Sergeant Pepper's got 13 songs. And
what's the seventh one?
Jacob and the Angels.
Oh, okay. Which is a great one. So, you know,
that's kind of the Mr. Kite of this album.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
So that every song doesn't have to be a bizarre romance if you buy an album. You know, you don't expect, but because it's a book, everybody thinks it's an anthology of bizarre romances, which is not what we meant.
Which is, frankly, when I opened the book, that's what I was expecting. I would get bizarre romance in every story. This is not what I got. There was a lot of bizarre, and there was some romance.
Well, the romance was ours, you know. Well, the romance is Audrey and me.
The working title was Inviting the Demons to Tea. And I defy you to categorize that. But of course, as soon as Eddie said bizarre romance, all the publishing people went, yeah, because they don't like the whole demons idea.
It's funny, the demons sounds like a Cat Stevens album or something like that.
Yeah.
So how did you guys decide on the stories that you were going to tell and then what your approach would be?
Essentially it was just Audrey had her collection of short stories and we said, let's turn these into an album, an album of comics. And we took it from there. But the challenge was to come up with the different ways of doing them. One of Audrey's stories is called The Composite Boyfriend. And describe the story then.
These stories were written over a period of about 15 years, and so when I heaped them all up in front of Eddie, quite a few of them were actually concerned with former boyfriends and all sorts of strange stuff that happened to me before we met. So it's a bit weird having your husband do all this stuff about your failed relationships, but this particular one, I was invited to be in an anthology called Mr. Wrong. And I think Harriet Brown, the editor, I think was hoping that everybody would come forth with their, you know, funny but anguished tales of failed, you know, egregiously failed boyfriend situations. But I'm intensely private, like to the point where I would never ever be able to write memoir. And I thought, okay, how can I hide this whole thing and yet still actually say what went on? So I decided to take about 8 different boyfriends and sort of put them all in a blender and mush them together. And so it starts off something like, you know, we met in 1985, we met in 1992, we met in 2001. And it just goes on like that, where it's all a big mush. And so Eddie confronted this thing and just went, right, paper dolls.
Well, yeah, how do you illustrate something like that? I was walking around the street, I think, when it occurred to me, paper dolls. You know, they're paper dolls. So you can see there's the guy, he's got all the attachments, you know, the clothes. You've got a choice of 2 different brains. There's a brain and a squirrel.
It's on a different page, but we're missing one of the key ones, which is, at the very end, you get a halo.
Well, the piece ends with the sentence, next time he will be perfect. And so the little tiny end piece is the bald-headed paper doll guy with his little halo that's ready to attach. So, yeah, make of that what you will.
I wanted to talk about the seventh song, or the seventh piece that we did, which is the Angels piece, which I really liked, and it felt like a departure for you, Eddie, because there's one incredible page where the angels are coming up. Do you have an image?
I don't have that one. Which one?
Oh, it's the one where the angels are flying up.
No.
It will be the one he doesn't have.
It's the one I don't have.
Okay.
In fact, a number of these pictures are gone missing in the night.
Who steals them? Is it the cobblers fairies that steal the pictures?
Well, I often find that when I draw late at night, when I get up in the morning, I usually find that, you know, the brownies have come the night and smudged the ink. Do you find this problem?
I don't know. Do stories get written for you, Audrey, by the cobblers or by the fairy cobblers, or do you have to work on every single word?
Yeah, anybody who's ever watched me do this will tell you that I do it by sitting there for hours on end, and there's like a little scribbly cloud above my head, you know, like in Charlie Brown comics, and that goes on for about 5 or 6 years, and then it's done.
Oh, no. I wonder.
But this story, we're going to talk about this story.
Yeah.
This is my favorite story of the last season. It's an outright comedy. It's about a Chicago man who. There's something in the loft. And he gets the exterminators in, and the exterminators say, that's not squirrels, you get angels. But that's all right. We can deal with it. And they go to the van, and say, what are you going for? He says, we'll get the flamethrowers. And it ends in this battle royal between the exterminators and the angels in the loft, which I've drawn like a big carpet page from an illuminated manuscript. And all the angels in this story will get red hair, because I was looking at the Book of Kells. I don't know if you've ever looked at reproductions of the Book of Kells, but because it was a book made in Ireland, Mary and Joseph and the angels and the evangelists, they've all got ginger hair. And ginger hair is, of course, a lovely thing. So the angels have got red hair. It's my favorite story.
Do you have a favorite story, Audrey? Is it like children? You can't choose one over the other. But they were being transformed, some of them, by Eddie, so...
Yeah, my favorite story, if they're off being stories, is different from my favorite story in the actual book. My favorite story in the book is called Motion Studies, and I wrote it in about 2 hours, and it was originally a performance piece, And it was kind of a very offhanded thing. I mean, I wrote it, I performed it the next night, and I thought no more of it, and it sat in the computer and never was published anywhere. And it was about 2 pages long. Originally, it was meant to be spoken in front of an animation of Edward Muybridge's photographs. He did all those beautiful early photographic studies of animals and people in motion. So,
did you do it to win a bet? Somebody was saying how many, when the horse is running, will all the legs ever leave the ground?
Yeah, he did it to find out if a horse is ever completely off the ground when it's running, but he saw that there was a lot more in it than just that, and went on to pretty much make that his life's work. But he had a favorite model, and we know her name. Her name was Blanche Epler. And that's about all we know about her, and I got kind of intrigued, and so I made up an entire inner life for her. And so in the story, she's a lot of these Muybridge photographs were made on a racetrack, and they had the cameras set up, and so, you know, the horse would go tripping wires, and that would set off all the shutters. But eventually they refined it so that horses and wires didn't have to make contact. But at any rate, he would have people doing all these things. They would be skipping or dueling or just all sorts of things. And one of the things was getting out of bed. So the thing that later became a bit tricky is that in the real photographs that he made of someone getting out of bed, it's not Blanche. And I knew that, and I had just sort of blithely conflated those two things, because when you're a fiction writer, you can do anything. You don't have to draw it. But Eddie got into this problem where Blanche, the person who's really in the photos, doesn't quite look like the woman that's in the story.
I had some beautiful photos to work with of Blanche doing these different things. Like there she is going fishing, for instance. But the problem was I was going to have to completely fabricate the final extravaganza where she gets out of bed. So the story is called Motion Studies, Getting Out of Bed. And as Audrey said, he tried to record all the simplest actions of everyday life with nude models. And it's a remarkable and brilliant research for artists or for anatomists, the people who, you know, a study of how the body moves and how all the muscles and limbs work when simple tasks are done. So I had to completely fabricate the final one. It's the 36 shots where she gets out of bed. There is a model who gets, The models had numbers in the original publications. I think Blanche was 87, but it's model 89 who's getting out of bed. So I had to just look at it and then kind of forget about it and do the rest completely from imagination, from my head. And that was that's Blanche getting out of bed.
So I want to ask you both this question, but I'll start with you. So a lot of your work has a lot of supernatural elements. I get the sense that you must love graveyards and you like sort of strange things, bizarre, perhaps. Perhaps one might use the word bizarre, things going on in your work. Why are you drawn to that?
What I always like is when the bizarre gets into ordinary life. And so when the world is totally bizarre, when everything is unrecognizable and kind of puts you off balance, I don't actually like that very much. But I grew up on TV shows like Bewitched, and that really pleased me, because it was this woman who was a witch trying to be really normal and married to this really normal guy who got a little upset whenever she did anything extraordinary.
And it doesn't date well.
No, it doesn't, but it's brilliant. It's brilliant anyway. And their struggles to kind of meet in the middle and be a good married couple, as though that was, you know, the highest possible fulfillment if you were a witch, to be some good 60s wife. Yeah, be ordinary. But, you know,
the highest aspiration back then was to be ordinary.
Yeah. But you can sort of extrapolate forward into what I'm doing in The Time Traveler's Wife, because Henry, the time traveler, is desperately trying to live a normal life and just, you know, be a good husband. And so I've just kind of done a little flipperoo on that. But the thing that pleases me is the idea that ordinary life could erupt into miracles and wonder at any moment.
And your work is that way too,
actually. I was just going to say that. It seems to me already that all kinds of, you're interested in all kinds of unreal, from wackadoodle science to the supernatural, you know, but and the whole gamut in between. There's surrealism. There's elements of the. There's one picture there where the teenage character finds herself in a. She's gone through the mirror and she finds herself in this realm of strange people. And I remember I asked you, I said, how do you see the beings of this other dimension? And you recommended that I look at the surreal paintings of Remedios.
Remedios Varo, she's a Mexican surrealist. And yeah, we ended up pinching quite a lot from her. So.
In her paintings, everybody seems to be going around in a little unicycle, which I used for... I don't know how you do it.
She also has facial hair that eerily presages the hipster Brooklyn facial hair thing. She's really worth a look if you don't already know her paintings.
But Eddie, you in Bacchus and some of your work, you were mining the same territory, but in a completely different way. You'd have a guy in a bar and all this mystical stuff was going on, but it always felt very mundane.
Every kind of unreal in a mundane world.
So I do have a question. You're both cartoonists. You both love comics. You both have been interested in comics since you were kids. What is it about the medium of comics that you find so exciting?
That is the very medium for the comic book is the medium for putting across the unreal. You can combine the scribble with the photographic in the same pictorial space more easily than in film or any other medium. What do you think, Dylan?
I was always trying to get the words and the pictures to be together, and when I was really small, I wanted to be a book illustrator, and I sort of gradually got the idea that that was a career from a bygone age. And I went to art school, and they kind of discouraged it. So I was like, okay, well, it's the early 80s, I'm in art school, right, then performance art. Performance art has the big disadvantage that it just evaporates. Like, you do it, you work really hard, you make this piece, you do it, and it just is gone, which is supposed to be one of the attractions, but I found that I really wanted it to still somehow exist. And
well, what about film? Would you ever think of doing a performance piece that would be filmed, or does that act actually transform the performance itself?
I was so broke. I couldn't afford film. Film was for the children of rich people. I was in art school from 81 to 85, and I had a budget of $100 a month to buy all my supplies and food. And that wasn't happening.
I remember back in the 70s, I was 1 year at art school, but I described what I wanted to do. Essentially, I was describing the graphic novel like years before it existed, and they just couldn't visualize that. They said, well, shouldn't you be doing animation or something? They had no idea what I was talking about. And many years later, I still have the same problem. On radio interviews or whatever, a graphic novel, what do you mean?
Well, I have to admit, it's a terrible term. Let's just all admit, graphic novel is terrible. Novel, not all the books that are graphic novels are novels. And they use graphics in a different way. Sequential art sounds so precious.
Yeah.
There's no term. Comic sounds too frivolous for what you're doing.
How about book? We could just call them books.
Have you seen the book?
But it doesn't work. The Toronto Comic Book Festival, it would send a whole different signal.
It would let the riffraff in.
So what were the overall themes that you were trying to deal with in Bizarro? It's a typical journalist type question. And at the end, did you feel that it was different from what you set out to do?
Well, the stories already existed, so we had a pretty good idea before we set out.
But you must have chosen them, because you are a very prolific writer, so you'd obviously were
thank
culling
you. I'm
stories.
Not. I'm so not.
Really?
Yeah, unfortunately. The way I work is I grind away in my room for years and then emerge with a thing after, 5 or 6 or 7 years. So yeah, I actually feel really slow. But
after wailing and gnashing of teeth.
Yeah, oh well. So yeah, I don't know, yeah. But it's not like it's a problem. I'm not mining coal or anything. It's just that, I wish I could be a little faster. I mean, I admire people who can do a book a year, who've got like 10 projects on the boil at all times. I mean, the fluency that is required to do that, I just am in awe of.
You're looking at me.
Well, you're the prolific one, too.
Prolific dude here, yeah.
Prolific dude.
Yeah.
I like that, prolific dude. Eddie Cowell, on your business cards, mate.
The prolific dude. Yeah, and it gets easier to be prolific, because now we can take Photoshop around on the computer. We work while at the airport while we're stuck for 2 hours. You actually work on the plane. I'll probably wear my eyes out swiftly in my final years.
So when you started this book, you weren't married. You knew each other, but you weren't married. Now you are married and collaborating together and living together. So what's that like, as two creative, very creative people living in the same house, collaborating together?
Well, we sit about, 15 feet apart. He has commandeered the dining room table in every place we go. The dining room table is his studio. We had Chris Ware and his family over to dinner, and later Chris, who's the most polite person on earth, he wrote and he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I guess I missed seeing your studio, Eddie." And we were like, no, you were sitting at it. Of course, we tidied everything away so we could serve dinner. But so we sit pretty close together, but I'm in my little, you know, cloud of scribbly, you know, complicated, ridiculous hesitations trying to write this novel. And meanwhile, Eddie's confidently getting on with his various projects.
Yeah.
Did knives come out of drawers or?
I will have colored a page while she's reading the paper over breakfast.
Oh dear.
Well, I mean, you couldn't expect somebody to work before noon, could you? That would be unreasonable.
While we're talking about your new novel, so the rumor is that it's a sequel to The Time Traveler's Wife. Can you confirm that?
Oh sure, yeah, that's not a secret.
Okay, good. You're never sure, because in circles, literary circles, things are like, oh, she's working on this, and then you find out it's not that at all, or you're told specifically, please don't ask me about such and such a thing. And you, Eddie, what are you working on?
What am I working on? I'm colorizing From Hell.
What? Okay, is this sacrilege? I don't know that I approve, Eddie. You're colorizing From Hell.
2 years old.
It's incredibly groovy. Don't prejudge.
I'm not going to prejudge, because V for Vendetta, but I still prefer V for Vendetta in the black and white before it became colorized.
I think this will be a generational divide. I think, as old codgers will still prefer the black and white one. But IDW wanted to put it out again as in parts, and tell us that going backwards. You know, we've got the parts, we've got the big book, and I said, well, it'll only work if you do something drastically different. Why don't we colorize it? I don't mean I've just inked in the colors. I've completely overhauled the whole thing. I'm working on fixing up some continuity errors and oversights and one or two problems that I know about. The second volume has got six panels that have never appeared before in any previous edition of From Hell, where I just replaced panels. You know, there's no new pages or sections. I'm just polishing it. I'm not redrawing it, because I don't think I can draw any better than I could 20 years ago. But there's just things that are or they're not supposed to be. And the book's so complicated that nobody's really noticed before. Like I've got Nedley wearing a huge big woolly scarf in the middle of summer. You know, on an August day, even in London, you don't need a big woolly scarf on a London day, on a summer day. So I've taken out the scarf. But things like that. And I've given him the same shape hat from panel to panel. You know, his hat changed. And he was driving a different carriage in one panel from the next panel. In one panel it looks like a limousine. He's sneaking around the poorer district in a limousine, and I thought, I've got to square this. This is bothering. This has bothered me for 30 years. And I thought somebody else would fix it. I'm going to do it myself.
Are you ever?
I thought you said it to the publisher, they fix all the mistakes. I realize now that it doesn't work that way.
So, Audrey, have you ever been tempted to go into your work and change it? Have you picked up The Time Traveler's Wife and gone, I should have done this or that, or do it? They now have author preferred editions, so people have gone into their work and changed it from time to time. A temptation for you?
Well, I'd never make anything new again, you know, because by the time you got back around, you'd see things to fix, and then you'd just do it over and over again like a squirrel. So. No.
I don't know who it was who said artists never finish their work, they simply abandon it, and maybe that's the way that it has to be.
It's wrenched from your dying hand, and taken out of your skeleton hand. That From Hell, they want to get out as early as September, I forgot to say. It'll be in 10 parts. Beginning in September. 10. Another problem, I think the problem they were thinking about was it's such a huge big, like $50 book. For a young person thinking, would I like this? I think it'd be easier to get in if it were a $6 or $7 part one. So
I don't know anymore. And
I don't know anymore.
What fascinates me right now about the current market is that digitally it has changed everything, and I go into a comic book store like the Beguiling, and they are doing extremely good business on $35, $40, $50 hardcover graphic novels. People want that stuff. I interviewed a woman yesterday who does a web comic, which you can get for free, and all these people have pledged $500,000 on Kickstarter so that it will be turned into a paper edition of her book, which they can, as I said, get for free. So now I'm seeing that if people love something, they're more than willing to spend the $30 or $40 or $50 to buy the product.
Well, at least at the moment, things on the internet, they can't really keep you company the same way an actual book can. You can't be in the room with your web comic in the same way. It can't just sit there on the shelf kind of smiling at you. And people are constantly bringing me copies of my books that are all swelled up from being read over and over, and it's brilliant. It's like they're bringing me their childhood teddy bear or something. And it's because they say to me, oh yeah, I had this all through India, or I read this on the beach in Michigan or whatever, and it's the physical copy being with them that matters, and you've got the web thing also.
But the book has the comic book is like tuned into another kind of sensibility. The idea of the beautiful book.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first put out the big 600-page edition of From Hell, which I published myself, it was terrifying. I just thought, how can I get the unit price as low? What's the cheapest paper I can print this on? Where, can you get toilet rolls and big, you know, like huge big cylinders that just run through the presses? How cheaply can I make this damn thing? Which was not the way the market was going. I was following Dave Sims' example at the time. Can we put this out on cheap newsprint? But the market swiftly changed due to Jimmy Corrigan and
Raw.
But I'm talking about I'm talking about it from 2000. You know, once Jimmy Corrigan came out in a book, and what other ones were? Have you seen Chris Ware's latest book, the huge big monolith or monograph or whatever he's called it? It's the idea of establishing a beautiful and perfect object in the world.
Building stories was the same way, where he took 15 completely different things, put them together. I don't know what it is. Is it a comic? It's a box of comics, I suppose. It's brilliant. I'll give him that.
That's the perfect example of what I'm trying to say. Yes, he's made a mysterious and beautiful object. You know, it's a box with 14 things in it. Is that how many it was? I can't remember. And there's no instructions as to what order you're supposed to look at them. It's a mysterious and magical object. And this kind of keys into where Audrey comes from, because her medium was the artist's book.
Yeah, I was about to say, in the world of artist books, Chris Ware's box of books is actually quite tame. Not to take anything away from Chris, because it's an incredible thing to get commercially published, something like that. But, you know, I mean, I come from a world where people are taking existing books and putting them through buzzsaws, and, you know, I had a student who made a planetarium that was also a book. You could walk into it, and you had to read it from underneath. So, you know, in my world, the book is a form that's infinitely expandable.
I come from Coach House, which was my first job, and we designed a book that would burn really well. We also designed a book of baseball poetry that was shaped like a baseball pennant, a triangle or baseball pennant. So I, too, that's my fascination. And the book as object idea goes back, I mean, maybe a day after Gutenberg came up with his press, somebody said, hey, these are going to be beautiful. And it even predates the printed book, because you have the Book of Kells, which you referenced earlier. But I have to say that as somebody in their 60s, the book as an object is the thing for me. I've never been able to have a to connect with the web in that way. And I know there are millions of people who do, because I see it. I know they do. But I have to, your book, your graphic novel was a turning point too, because you were a respected literary figure who was doing comics. Chris Ware was seen as a guy who did comics, but then he won the Whitbread Prize, which really was, you're right, it was a turning point. But you it looked to outsiders like you were coming from a different angle.
Chris and I went to the same art school, and we didn't overlap, but almost. And so in my head, we come from a very similar place, although his lifelong obsession with comics is of a completely different order than mine. But yeah, I mean, a lot of things that seem really different actually have so much in common, and, you know, it's one of those glass half full, half empty situations. So yeah, I think most people who are interested in books, I mean, I know there are people who only want to read Westerns or something like that, but most people who are interested in books are happy to range wild and free and try things out, I think.
I was in a restaurant once with Audrey and Chris Ware, and from the other side of the restaurant I saw somebody get out a little notebook, and they were coming over for an autograph, and I thought, who's this for? Is it for Eddie Campbell, Chris Ware, or Audrey Niffenick? It was for Audrey. The person didn't know who Chris and I were. We were completely nobodies.
Would you like to comment on that, Audrey?
No.
So I think I'm going to do the humane thing now and open it up to the audience, and if you have any questions. I really didn't get back into their old material. We haven't really touched on the stuff that you did before Bizarro Mess, but if you guys want to, or if you have more questions about the new book, which I should actually have professionally put up like that. So any questions? Don't be shy.
Everybody's just waking up.
Go ahead, sir.
So, who did the cover for that, and how much say did you have for that?
I made the little drawing. It was one of the situations where we were all brainstorming, and I said to Eddie and Ken, my assistant, I said, how about this, you know, on an envelope? And Eddie's like, yep, that's it, and ran off with it, scanned it in.
Was that so?
Yeah. And
I said, I'll blow it up. I'll make it work.
Yeah, so he made it work, and we were collaborating. The cover is kind of a four-way collaboration between the two of us, Ken Gerlieve, and the designer who worked on it, Sarah Edwards Corbett. So it was a real kind of group effort there.
So the publisher wasn't twisting your arm for pink and all that?
No, that's an in-joke with us.
It got to the pink. It got to the pink by the time it got to the publisher. But once we started, that was the inevitable. Ken had the idea, he was leaning towards spoofing the idea of romance. And I said, no, we've got to be serious. If you're going to do romance, you've got to be serious, because too often, and I'm not saying Ken is guilty of it, but too often, it is women's fiction that's kind of looked down upon, and it's regarded as frivolous and foolish. Whenever romance comics are suggested or referenced, it's usually to say that how stupid they were, romance comics, as though any other kind of comics isn't stupid.
Eddie loves romance.
I collect the old romance comics. They get a lovely drawing. You get the best drawing in the romance comics because they're drawing real people. And there's no foreshortening, exaggerations, or people striding around with unfeasible musculature. It's real people doing real stuff, even if most of the time it's a bit silly. But the earliest ones, you know, from 1947 to 1951, that's strange. Different stories before they decided what a romance comic was. Before they decided it was about a teenager sobbing. There were lots of different kinds of a variety of different approaches and different kinds of story.
before the Comics Code came in and sapped into its energy, I think it was a very lively genre.
I have to defend the genre too, because when I didn't really have a lot of money and I couldn't afford the really, you know, the good comics, the expensive comics, but you could buy romance comics for like 5 cents, 10 cents, and no one cared. And then you discover Our Love Number 5, written and drawn by Jim Steranko. And then you'd see, oh, Gene Colan, John Buscema. You suddenly realize that all these guys, before superheroes took off, the best artists in the business were doing this material. And Jack Kirby did some of the greatest romance comics.
Yeah, he introduced the genre to comics in 1947. And his main output for the next 13 years, I think, was the romance comic. Because they actually packaged it themselves, Simon and Kirby, for the publisher. And all the great artists did romance comics, because romance was the most popular genre. In 1950, romance was the biggest genre in comics, the biggest selling genre in comics, hundreds of thousands. And all the great artists, you know, Frazetta, Alex Toth, they all drew comics. And you can find the best examples of the drawing in those romance comics, because the biggest market for illustration in the 1950s was the women's magazine. So I'm sure a lot of them saw it as a kind of practice, a chance to get together samples of women's fiction to show editors that they could do this stuff. And so they did their best drawing in the romance comics.
Yeah. Anyway. Yes, sir.
It sounds like the process for creating this book was taking stories that existed, and then you guys sort of operated all them together from a distance, and that's one way to do something together. But would it be very different or possible to create something from the ground up, like a stories and interests creation?
That's yeah.
Look, he's making this face like he's never thought of it before. Yeah, we met each other in 2012, and the first collaboration, the one Paul Gravett invited us to do, was in 2013, and so we were gradually getting closer together on the globe. So he went from Australia to London, and then now we both live in Chicago together in one house. So it would be, it's getting easier and easier to actually do that, but first we have to finish all the other projects that were on the boil before.
But there was one story there where we were both hands-on. The one we were talking about a minute ago, the motion studies, the story about Blanche Heckler, and everything that goes through her head in the 10 minutes before she has to get out of bed for the cameras. But because we were with the character completely in those 10 minutes, Audrey had written it in the past tense, and I thought, traditionally comics are written in the present tense. Even something as elaborate as Prince Valiant was always written in there, as you would remember, always written in the present tense. And I thought, this one story cried out to be done in the present tense, because we're in the room, we're waiting for something to happen. And I said to Audrey, I'll change the tenses, don't worry.
What he actually said was, oh, well, I've made a change here, but don't worry. And I'm like, what did you do? What'd you do? And he's like, oh, well, I'll show you later. La, la, la. And I'm like, oh, shit, what's he done? So, yeah, I didn't find out for weeks and weeks. He sort of ran off with it, you know, clutching it secretively, and I thought, I don't know.
Because the problem is, once you change the present, then you've got the past becomes past perfect, and the future, and they all follow, all the tenses follow over that domino, so each one's going to be changed to the next one up.
He eventually brought me back in again for help with unsnarling them.
We needed to do a lot of damage. We needed to sit down together and do a bit of damage control to make all the tenses work. But we finally got it to where we were both happy with it. But there was one evening where Audrey stormed out in a huff.
I didn't storm anywhere. I just went, huh.
To us men, that's a major huff.
See, Eddie was married for almost 30 years, and so he has lots of practice at assigning sort of viewing what must be going on in my head. And meanwhile, I've never been married before, so I'm just like, okay, I'm just doing what I do. But I think sometimes in his head it's the wife. I've assumed the character of the wife, and I'm doing that wife thing. So I think this little interaction fell into that category. So I thought I was behaving as myself, but I'd actually stumbled into an ongoing wife situation.
Welcome to couples therapy here at TGAF. Can this marriage be saved? Is really the question we're all asking. Sorry, another question. Yes?
Do you guys keep up with new releases in the comic industry? And if so, what are some of your favorites of the new voices in comics?
Not really, unless somebody crosses my path. Like, for instance, there's a young fellow named Landis Blair who did a marvelous book called The Hunting Accident. It's a huge, big, thick book from first to second. I have drinks with him every Wednesday. I make friends easily. And we have drinks every Wednesday, and I have to be decanted into the taxi home. But this was a book about... somebody else wrote it, but it was a great book. It was a book about... Who were the two murderers? Leopold and Loeb. And Loeb was murdered in prison, I think. But Leopold... Oh, they went to different prisons. Leopold shared this cell with a fellow who was blind. He got shot he got shot in the face while robbing a corner store or something. But Leopold taught him how to write Braille for his own ends, because he wanted to read after lights out, and he couldn't have ordered a book on Braille for himself. So he saw this opportunity to learn Braille, teach this guy Braille, and be able to read after lights out. And it's a brilliant beginning of a story. There's not a lot in it, but the essential idea expands into a very thick book that's full of dark complexities. So Landis Blair. So who's the other Chicago lass? Emil Ferris.
Emil Ferris is a genius.
It's an extraordinary book. I'm going to get the title wrong. I Love Monsters. Is that what it is?
My Favorite Thing is Monsters.
Sorry, My Favorite Thing is... I always get it.
I'm sure everybody here has already seen this because it was the coolest thing ever. But, yeah, Emil.
I didn't know she was from Chicago. And you got Jill Thompson. You got a... Man, Chicago is...
Mecca for comics. Yeah, I just wanted to take your question as an opportunity because I was just downstairs at the Self-Made Hero booth and... They were so kind as to give me Andrzej Klimowski's two brilliant new things. So this is his Polish theater posters, and this is a new one that I haven't even seen yet. But Andrzej Klimowski is this absolutely fantastic Polish-English artist who I've been following him for years and years. Somebody gave me a copy of The Depository years ago, which is a wordless novel. And he's done all these interesting... kinds of ways to get the words and the images together, but his stuff is just gorgeous, and he's very versatile, and I just adore his work.
Lucky one of his, what was it? The one of the professor who oddly decides to take a jazz band on his lecture tour. What was it? What was that one called?
Let's see, there's The Secret?
No, I forgot anyway.
Anyway,
he's full of peculiar and interesting ideas, Klimowski.
Yeah. Wasn't really directed towards me, but I don't know if anybody has seen Marc Antoine Watteau's book 3 Seconds. Has anybody seen that book? It's what happens in 3 seconds, and it's like frames. And the reason that I'm thinking of it today is because of your referencing of My Bridge. It's one of the most extraordinary visual experiences that I've ever had, and no one has ever remotely tried something so intellectually bananas. I mean, it's a banana story, and every single panel is sequential.
I'm sure he would love to have that blurb, intellectually bananas.
So we're kind of winding up. It's 11:25. So one last question, and then... Yes?
Okay, is there one story that Eddie adapted where you're like, this is exactly what I saw in my head?
One of the things that was really interesting about doing this collaboration is that usually I'm my own illustrator, but in most of these stories I hadn't specified what the narrator looks like, because of course it's not that easy to have first-person narrators going around describing themselves. I mean, we don't all walk around thinking, you know, oh, I have red hair and I have glasses. So there's a lot of space for him to create these characters, most of whom were female, and so he ended up having fun making these wildly different women. And it was very cool for me because I had sometimes imagined them differently, but as soon as he established what they looked like, that's what they look like. And it was just like there was a missing thing that I didn't understand was missing, and all of a sudden there it was, and it was extremely satisfying. So yeah, I mean, especially the very last story, which is called Backwards in Seville. I originally wrote that for a Ray Bradbury tribute anthology, and it's sort of a reaction to his story, The Playground. And the main character is this 40-ish woman who's really unhappy with her life, and Eddie managed to convey her unhappiness not just in facial expressions, but she sort of feels like she's wasted her life, and he manages, by the way he's drawing her, to show not only that she's unhappy, but also that she's kind of fading out of her own life.
I usually work from out of focus, too sharp, you know. I already push the line in right away, but I have to be vague and find the line. But more and more with this character, I was leaving her out of focus. It seemed to express the idea best that she was coming in and out of focus behind her sharply defined glasses. It's just an odd graphic thing that seemed to work when I found by accident. But yeah, the comics is all these peculiar ways we find of putting across the meaning of the thing. You know, sometimes we find it while we're just muddling around on the page and think, oh yeah, that says it. That says what I was trying to say. I leave it that way.
Well, it's always interesting because there are so many parts of your brain that don't actually use language, and when you have the pictures also, it enables you to access all these very interesting ideas that can't exactly be put into words. And so one of the nice things about collaboration is not only do you access all those non-verbal things, but you get somebody else's reams of strange subconscious ideas. And so yeah, it was actually very exciting to do it.
I just wanted to show one of my favorite examples. So this is the kind of fractured face from one of the stories, which I just thought was brilliant, and somebody has to choose. But
what was it she described as?
She's cubist, yeah.
Yeah, this is the cubist. And then, of course, the next two, one is, well, I'll let you decide. But that I thought, wow, that is a great way to think. Like, this is taking it into a way that I wouldn't have thought of. And yet the image was so powerful.
Well,
wow! I
found it more and more with the book. Audrey was happiest when I would do a big picture, because it's not my conventional way to do huge big pictures. I usually break the page into little units, little components. But Audrey was showing more and more pleasure if I would do a big picture. So like when the guy turns into a monster, it was just a small picture in the original Guardian printing, and she says, oh, it's a shame that it couldn't have been a big picture.
Well, if you have a monster, you need it to be a big monster.
It needs to be a splash page. Yeah. Audrey is right. So on that note, thank you all very much for coming, and Audrey and Eddie will be around the festival all day today. Are you doing another big thing?
No, we're going to be downstairs at the Abrams booth, which is number 111, and we'll sign things if you bring them, and we have things to buy, and it will be glorious.
But don't leave it too long. We're probably going to have to go at 2 o'clock to catch our plane.
Yeah, we have to go back home. We can't live here.
I hope they'll let me back into the States. I don't know.
So we have a big round of applause for Audrey.